Session number 12962.
Brigadier Warren, Reel 3. Going back to flying into British Honduras from Jamaica, I remember in the aircraft looking out of the window as we drew near to Belize, it was quite extraordinary that houses, because they're all wood, the houses there, had been caught by the tidal wave and they were floating in the sea. I had never envisaged anything like this, but it does indicate the force of the hurricane and the tidal wave, which normally comes after. I think that brought it home to me that we were in for a very complicated problem. And the other aspect of this, of course, the external threat in British Honduras, is always from Guatemala on the border. The Guatemalans have always laid claim to British Honduras. And so one of the things I had to consider was it might be an appropriate moment for the Guatemalans to try and get in. Not that I would envy the task of those having to do it, but I mean it would be difficult to organize the opposition for them, because we were all embroiled with the clearing up operation after the hurricane. And that, I think, is really all I have to say about Belize.
What was the attitude of the soldiers towards doing this kind of work?
Oh, the attitude was first class. It was something for them to do, and something original. And I think the Hampshire soldiers, anyway, always seemed to react very well. It was clearly a challenge, and they wanted to show everybody what they could do.
And the Belize people, what was their attitude towards what the army and the navy did?
The attitude of the Hondurans, the Belize people, the people in the street, they were very appreciative of it all. We'd always had very good relations with the people of Belize, with the company that was permanently there. And I think they realized that we virtually were saving their lives.
Could we go on now to the second thing in Central America or South America, the next year in British Guyana?
Yeah, I have to try and get my mind working a bit. In January, I think it must have been, of 1962, in Georgetown, which is the capital of British Guiana, they were expecting a visit from Prince Philip. And it was at this time, I was in Jamaica, which was my permanent location, that I got word from British Guiana. The governor wanted to see me about the security situation, as it seemed likely there might be a general strike. To complicate everything, the colonel of my regiment was coming out on a visit, and he came to Jamaica first. And he was going to Georgetown to see the company there. That was part of his program. And suddenly a signal came in saying that I should get myself over to Georgetown. And he wanted to come because he was the colonel's regiment and things were looking not too good in British Guiana. So he decided to come. And so we arrived in British Guiana, in Georgetown, and went to the governor, who gave us a very clear briefing on the situation, which was building up to a general strike. And it was rather curious in a way, because all the streets in Georgetown were decked out for the visit of Prince Philip. And there was an atmosphere of malevolence, I would say, because it looked as though the two elements of the population of British Guiana, that is the Negroes and the Indians, they'd always disliked each other. And the Negroes particularly disliked Dr. Jagan, who was an Indian, who was the Prime Minister. They always thought he was trying to take over the place. Anyway, there I was with the governor and the colonel of the regiment. So we were able to get him out of it, get him home to Jamaica, while we set about setting up an operation to reinforce British Guiana, Georgetown. Meanwhile, the company was on standby to move into Georgetown, and I'd hoped that we wouldn't have to get them in, because I thought the sight of British troops in a delicate political security situation might just cause people to go over the top. Anyway, the crowd started to gather after about a couple of days, and word was the police were going on strike, and the prison staff, which was rather worse, because all the criminals would then be let loose. And if there were no police, it was difficult to see how we were going to keep law and order in Georgetown with one company. And I was staying with the governor in Government House. And on a particular day, the crowds were gathering and were threatening, to say the least of it. And I decided I'd have to bring the company in. So I got them into to Georgetown. And the crowds were looting and breaking the police up. And also there had been some shots fired, too. Anyway, we got the company in into the middle of Georgetown. And they proceeded to, in imperial style of internal security, forming up with fixed bayonets and steel helmets. Although they opened fire, there were some casualties. The situation was restored in a few hours. The crowds disappeared. But prior to that, there'd been a lot of fire raising, and a lot of Georgetown was burning, because they're all wooden houses there, and of course once you start one, it soon spreads.
Who was attacking whom?
The Indians and the Negroes. They were the people who were at it. The Indians, of course, were the followers of Dr. Jagan, the Prime Minister, and the Negroes, in fact, followed Mr. Burnham. And it was rather funny that Mr. Burnham, of course, I think he called in a lot of Negroes to make the thing worse. And he, in a way, I think he'd been the architect of it. And during the course of all that, in Government House, I remember he suddenly appeared and said he wanted to see the governor. And he was in an office outside the governor's office, and I saw him there. And the governor came out and gave him a real dressing down, saying that he should hold himself responsible for what was happening in Georgetown, because he'd obviously called in all these other people. And he said to me afterwards, he said, "It's the first time I've seen a Negro go white in the whole of my time in the colonial service." Anyway, the company restored law and order, and that night I sent patrols out in vehicles all over Georgetown to make sure that the crowds didn't gather again. Of course, I had several telephone calls from Dr. Jagan saying that he was going to be murdered. And would I send him protection? And I said, it isn't up to us to protect you. You must use your police And he was angry about that. But still, I couldn't tie out my soldiers guarding him, as he'd been one of the leading participants, I think, in getting the riots going.
Was that because he couldn't get police protection?
Well, so he said, but of course he wanted to have the British Army, because he knew he'd be as secure if he got them. So we stayed there, I suppose, for about 6 weeks. Meanwhile, we were reinforced with the 1st Battalion of the East Anglians, and a company of the Duke of Edinburgh's was put under command. And we had a substantial garrison compared to the normal level of one company. And we had no trouble. It was very curious that after the rioting, it was perfectly safe to go around. And the Guyanese, I think they were ashamed of themselves that they had done this. I could go out in Georgetown, could get my hair cut or some simple thing like that, and feel perfectly safe. In fact, I think they rather liked me because I was the man they thought that had restored a law and order. And relations between the army and the civil population was absolutely first class.
Did you meet Chedi Jagan?
Dr. Jagan, I just met him. And there are one or two stories, but perhaps I think the tape isn't the place to tell them. But
please carry on.
Dr. Jagan, he was an Indian dentist, really. He, of course, I knew his house where he lived, where he had several others. And it was reported that his wife was having an affair with one of his ministers. It was reported that a revolver shot was heard to come from his house. And it seemed to be on investigation. What happened was that he had a pistol and he was loading it or unloading it or doing something to it, and it went off. And the bullet went through the ceiling into his wife's room, and the minister concerned was next seen coming down the stairs very rapidly. So I think he thought he was under fire. But that ended all right.
Did you meet Mrs. Jagan?
I've never met Mrs. Jagan, no. I've seen her. So that was really the end of it.
Were there actual deaths?
In the rioting, oh yes. I forget how many. I think two or three.
Were there through firing or through
through the firing of the soldiers? Yes, they fired. They were warned. They had a magistrate there to read the riot act to them, and then they didn't disperse, and fire was opened. Of course, this was a long time ago. You want to remember? This was in 1962 or two, was it, or 63?
And all this happened before Prince Philip arrived.
Yes, he never came. I think they cancelled him. When things were building up, I think the governor advised him not to come. But it was pretty grim, really. And it was particularly grim when the intelligence organization was telling us that the police were going on strike. And the prison warders were going on strike. So presumably we were expecting all the criminals to get out. And in a town with no police, you can imagine what the result of that might have been.
Were the police and prison warders from the African population or the Indian population?
They were, I think they were split. Some Indians and some Negroes. But it was very tricky at one point in that operation, because we only had a company there, and to keep law and order in a town which is quite a size, Georgetown, really.
What did the soldiers feel about doing the job?
Well, I think they always like something which, you know, they have to do as part of their duties. I think they like doing it. I don't think they particularly enjoyed opening fire, but who does?
But they wanted to get away from the routine.
But getting out of the routine and getting the excitement of the situation and a very clearly defined task for them, what they had to do, I think they liked that.
So how long did it last?
What
the riots?
The rioting was all over on that day when the Hampshire Company came in. And then I think the garrison, as I said, was reinforced with another battalion and another company, which came under command of the Hampshires. I suppose we were there probably for 5 or 6 weeks.
When the firing on the crowd took place, did the crowd have anything in the way of stones or sticks or anything of that kind?
Well, there had been shots fired. We'd heard the shots. And of course they had sticks and stones. And of course the thing that they always have in the West Indies, they have the machete too, which is what you've got to look out for. And I think what had happened, the ringleaders had probably had some rum and one thing or the other, and had roused the crowd to violence. And as I said, I think on the following day, I think the people concerned, that they were really sorry for what they had done.
Was it the ringleaders who were picked out?
Well, that is what you should do. You should, if you can see a ringleader, he's the one that you should fire at.
Could we go on to the third thing now, which was Libya?
Libya, that in fact we weren't involved in the revolution. We were a military mission there, and this was the revolution that put Colonel Gaddafi in power in Libya. Now, what was rather curious, of course, is that we had had no intelligence about this revolution. And Gaddafi, I think, was a captain in the Libyan army's signals. And most of the revolutionary command council, I think, came from the signals, who were located in Benghazi. Now, as I say, we had no intelligence about this revolution, so they kept it pretty quiet. And what happened, it was, I remember a Saturday morning, that there was a ring at the doorbell in my house. And I saw a friend of mine outside who was the head of BAT in Libya. He said, "We can't get into Benghazi. The Libyan army are out in strength." And he said, "I don't know what's going on, but we can hear firing." So I said, "Right, well, we'll have to see what goes on." And I got myself dressed, and I went off to see what was going on, and it was quite clear that the Libyan army were out in strength, and it didn't need a military genius to work out that obviously the source of the revolution going on was the Libyan army. They were taking over. Now, I lived outside Benghazi in my house. We could hear a lot of shooting. And I lived opposite the house of the American consul in Benghazi. And he was normally guarded by the Libyan police, but the policeman had disappeared. And outside my house, there was no sign of a policeman. And soldiers eventually arrived and disposed themselves around. And I had outside my house some Libyan army soldiers. And they, at one moment, they came in and they said they wanted a drink. And I said I would give them water. They said no, they wanted alcohol. And I said, no, you can have water. I can speak Arabic, actually, so it's not very difficult. So that was that. But what they did was to sit in the garden, and they had with them a Bren gun, and every 5 minutes or so, they used to fire it off, up into the air. And now, I'd been in touch with the rest of the mission, and I had told them that they couldn't get into the barracks, and so they must stay in their houses and not to do anything or involve themselves with the Libyans, and to get in touch with me if there's any difficulty. The telephone system, I think, was out of action. I remember I couldn't get in touch with the embassy in Benghazi. They were their telephone had gone. And the Libyan technique of internal security was to do a lot of shooting into the air. I think there were only one or two people who were killed in the revolution. They frightened them by firing into the air. They brought in some armored cars and so on. And it was very difficult to know what was going on, because at that moment Gaddafi's name hadn't appeared. Now, there was a certain amount of activity on the broadcasting side, and we heard that a certain colonel appeared to be in charge of the revolution, because in the mission we were split between Benghazi and Tripoli. It was about 600 miles away. And on the embassy radio link, we had got some information about what was going on in Tripoli, and all was well. But it was a very nasty situation, because the Libyan army are not all that well disciplined, and they had a curfew. Now, I think they had it on for about 2 or 3 days, and then they let it off for 2 hours so we could get to the shops to get some food. And I thought this might be an opportunity for me to get into the embassy in Benghazi, right in the town center. And I tried to do so, and I was stopped at a roadblock. And a Libyan army soldier thrust the muzzle of his rifle into my face and was very aggressive. He said, "Where are you going?" And I told him where I wanted to go. So he wouldn't allow it. And so I thought, I don't think I'm going to pursue this with them. So I had to go home and hope the telephone lines would get on. But my wife had gone off herself to the supermarket to get some bread and so on. And I was rather worried about her, really, that she was on her own. One never knows what's going to happen, because there's no real law and order. I mean, even at the best of times, it isn't all that good. And she went off anyway, and she was there, and she got what she wanted and came back. She was in her own car. And then later we realized that, or we knew that Colonel Gaddafi was the leader of the revolution. And I remember going to Tripoli, and I had to see the ambassador. And he said, I'm pleased that you're here, because I've been summoned to meet the Revolutionary Command Council at midnight tomorrow night. They always seem to work at night, the revolutionaries. So I remember going with him to the place where we were to have this meeting. And going in, there was no electricity. There were only oil lamps, And the Libyans were all in their combat suits and with their weapons, which they put on the table. And there was a British ambassador sitting there. It seemed to be a most bizarre situation. Colonel Gaddafi himself wasn't there, but Major Jalloud, who had been his second in command, and he made him the prime minister, he was the negotiator, and he started off with a harangue about the Balfour Declaration and the Palestine problem. And a little progress was made, but one thing they did make clear is that we would have to evacuate the base which we had at El Adam. And we could hardly disagree. We had to tell him that, of course, that was a matter for the British government, not for us to decide. We lived this extraordinary state. I was there for a year after the revolution, where we had little contact with the Libyans, really. They were, in fact, not very happy. And one day, looking out of the window of the embassy, they suddenly saw, it was right by the harbor in Tripoli, they saw tanks being unloaded from a Russian ship. And we found out that in one of the barracks, there were about 20 T-34s, to pretty old Russian tanks that they'd got. I think they'd got them from the Egyptians, but they were obviously getting further vehicles and military equipment in by sea. So we concluded it must have made some deal with the Russians. And then part of the duties of the mission, we used to have someone with a pair of field glasses to watch the harbor, watch for the vehicles to be unloaded and to count them as they came in. But our contacts had gone completely by this time with the Libyan army. And I don't think anybody knew who was in charge of it, really. Previously, there had been a group of colonels who we had thought might one day make an effort to take over Libya. But one of them, the chief one almost, was a man called Colonel Shelhi, who was a great personal friend of the king. The king actually was out of the country when the revolution occurred. But one of the first things they did in the revolution was to arrest a number of senior officers in the army, because Gaddafi was really only a captain, which they did. And to cut the story short, I was there for a further year after that, and there was no further revolution and very little effort made by the Libyans to get rid of the revolutionaries, which we thought might well occur. But the Libyans just hadn't got the go to do it, I think.
What did you exactly mean when you said the Libyans were unhappy?
Well, I think the Libyans didn't like the laws being and orders being given by the Revolutionary Command Council. The Libyans